Hi there, this is Mary Beth Monroe, and you are watching... Nope, you're not watching. You're listening to Improv Nerd. What's going on?
Jimmy Corain's a nerd. Jimmy Corain's an improv nerd. Jimmy Corain's a nerd. Oh, Jimmy. Jimmy Corain.
Hey everybody, Jimmy Corain. This is another episode of Improv Nerd, sponsored by the good people at Hotel Lincoln. The next time you find yourself here in the city of Chicago, and you are looking for a cool boutique hotel that's close to everything, it's right around the corner from Second City, it's across the street from the Lincoln Park Zoo, and it's minutes from Chicago's Loop. Check out the official hotel of Improv Nerd, and it's not only pet friendly, but it's improviser friendly as well. Not many hotels can say that. The Hotel Lincoln. And if you want to study with me, Jimmy Corain, in my award-winning improv classes here in Chicago, the Artist Low Comedy, where you'll learn how to be real before you can be funny, go to jimmycorain.com. Registration is now open for our June classes and our July intensive. All classes are limited to 12 people, so you get plenty of stage time and personal attention. Check it out at jimmycorain.com. Oh, brother, do we have a show for you today. You know her from the hit series on Comedy Central, Workaholics, where she plays Alice. She's also been in a lot of TV and film parts and millions of commercials. She just was cast in an HBO series called Brink. Our guest today is Mary Beth Monroe. And this episode was recorded as part of the Chicago Improv Festival. 17 years it's been around, and it was just such an honor to be a part of it. I love this episode. In this interview, Mary Beth talks about how she started out in improvisation. And it's an incredible story. She doesn't have much experience before she gets hired for the Detroit main stage. She talks about going from Detroit to Chicago to Los Angeles. And we talk about how she got hired for Workaholics. The thing I loved about this episode is she talked about something that I suffer from, and that is people pleasing. And if you don't know what people pleasing is, people-pleasing is that thing where you want to have everyone like you. And in my case, I have it very severely, and there's no medication on the market as of now that can help me with it. It's that thing where I try to get in other people's heads. You know, like if I say this, I'm not going to offend them. If I say this, they're going to like me more. And I've been doing that my whole life. So it's no surprise that I do it on stage. I do it in the classroom. I do it when I do this podcast. I don't know if I'm doing it right now. I'd have to think about that. No, I'm not doing it right now. But it's one of those things where, like, when I'm teaching a class and if the class isn't happy at the end, I feel like I've done something wrong. I'm bad. If I do a show and the audience doesn't like me, I feel I've done something wrong. I feel bad about myself. If I make a move on stage or say something that another teammate doesn't pick up on, I feel like, oh my God, you know, they're going to be mad at me. I've done something wrong. Anytime someone is mad at me, I feel like I've done something wrong. To me, that's people pleasing. And that I am ripping off everybody. I'm ripping off you that are listening to this podcast right now. I'm ripping off my classes. I'm ripping off the audiences when I improvise because they're not getting authentic Jimmy. They're not getting my authentic self. They're getting a watered down version. I'm trying to guess what you think. I'm trying to guess, get in your head and think what you think is going to be funny or what you think is going to make you like me. I'm not that powerful. I'm screwed up, that's for sure, but I'm not that powerful. And I loved Mary Beth's experience and just her honesty about it. And, you know, when I can get people on this podcast that are at Mary Beth's level and they can talk this honestly and then they still struggle with this stuff, it makes me feel like I'm doing a service. And I really enjoyed this episode. I loved improvising with Mary Beth. You're going to love, you know what? If you love it or not, I don't care. I loved it. This improv that we did with Mary Beth, or I did with Mary Beth in the Starbucks. Here it is. I hope you enjoy it as much as I do. And I don't even care because I liked it. Here it is. I love you guys. The Mary Beth Monroe episode.
Oh, yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd.
Over here. This was 2 years in the making. Do you remember?
2 years. Yes.
2 years. We were at the Detroit Improv Festival.
Yes.
And we were supposed to do this. And yes. Then you send this guy over. What was his name? Keegan Michael Key.
I know.
I don't know what happened
really
to him.
Really sorry about
yeah,
that.
Yeah. And you know, he's
It was Tank City, right?
Yeah, it was. And so we finally get to do this. And you've been so kind and going back and forth to make this happen. I just want to thank you.
Thank you. And you have been so kind. I was a little nervous. I'll let you guys know about being interviewed. I had a couple of kind of interesting podcast interviews where some unexpected questions were asked and whatever. So I was a little insecure coming here today. And Jimmy was awesome and made me feel very confident.
Okay,
so,
well,
thank you.
I'm a little nervous, too.
Cut to bomb drop.
Right.
Horrible question.
All right.
He's totally going to do it. Ready? No,
no.
I'm just kidding.
We'll start it. We'll go easy.
We'll go easy.
Because I don't know. It's like okay, we're, you know, it's like, you know what I'm saying?
Oh, totally.
Where do I go? How far do I go?
I don't know.
Okay.
Where do we go?
And I'm so glad that you spoke about it, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm all about protecting myself from things.
Are you
that
serious?
Make me uncomfortable.
Are you
yes.
serious?
Oh, yeah. I like to. Now I do. I think I. There was a time where I was much more like, everything's going to be great because who's not going to love me? And then I'd walk into situations and sure, yeah.
Is you become more successful, you get more protective, you do more commercial work, you're more protective?
I think I learned this really awesome thing called boundaries, which
okay.
is great. And
I've heard of them.
You've heard of them?
Yeah.
Do you actively?
I try. Both
yes.
my wife and I really try to with the boundaries thing, because
yeah.
we're very codependent people.
Yes,
yeah.
I understand that
yeah.
as well. I don't think I really understood that having boundaries also helps the people in my life be happier in our relationship as well.
Right.
And that was something I didn't understand. So
the other thing that when I don't set boundaries, this show is all on boundaries, just so you know.
That's all.
It prevents me from having resentments.
Yes.
You know?
Oh, absolutely.
Is it hard for you to say, now it sounds like you've changed, but was it hard for you to say no to things?
Oh, that's still very hard for me to say no. Yeah. I'm very much a people pleaser. I'm very much like want everybody to like me, want everybody to be happy. And it's hard to, yeah, it's very, still very hard to say no, but I have gotten better. I still might say yes, but then I'll inundate the person with, okay, if we do this, mm-hmm. how's it going to go? And you're not going to surprise me. Like, I am better at like kind of navigating the situation.
Now, your success, and
yeah.
it's great. The thing is, are you comfortable with it? Is there a part of you that's like feel guilty about it at all?
You know, there was a time where I did feel, you know, I don't know if we're going to get into this in this podcast, but I did feel guilty a lot during my time at Second City about my success there.
Mm-hmm.
I, you know, I had a pretty fast track in my hiring at Second City and my time in the Second City Chicago, and I think I did have a little bit of guilt about that. I still gave it 100%, and I tried not to let it impact the work I did or the relationships I had, but I did always feel like, gosh, I you know, I wish I did have that IO background, and I wish I did have that annoyance background, and I feel like people think I'm a poser, and I don't know what I'm doing, and I learned most of what I was doing on stage, and you know.
So let's talk about this because this
sure.
is great. You're waitressing at Second City Detroit.
Yes.
And Naima Funk, who's on the main stage there, orders
yes.
chicken wings.
Yes.
Tell us what happens after that.
Okay. So I'll give a little backstory. So I was working at the Second City Second City Detroit as a cocktail waitress for probably maybe 2 months at this time. Had gotten to know the cast really well. I had written one show through improvisation at my college with the with one of the cast members, Larry Joe Campbell. So I had a little bit of experience, but I had just signed up for my level one class, and I was about to start it in a week, and we get a discount being cocktail waitresses there. So I was really excited about it. And this time I'd fallen in love with improv. I thought it was magic. I was like, I don't know how they do it. It's incredible. They were my idols, and I was really excited about it. And then we had a new producer come in named Joe Janes, who was our new producer at the Second City Detroit. And one of the cast members was leaving, Margaret Exner, who I adored. And they decided that they were going to switch things up from their normal hiring process. And they were going to have the cast bring people up that they liked. and audition them on stage in sets in front of the audience over, yeah, right? Over like, I know, it's a it never happened again. If that's, it never happened again. But it, this, and they would do sets for like a few weeks and then everybody would weigh in and it'd be this great community kind of hiring experience. Everybody would get their 2 cents. And so Naima one night ordered chicken fingers. It was fingers, okay. Jimmy, not wings.
I got to check on my research. I had it that it was
fact check.
Okay, I had it was that it was honey mustard.
No, it was ranch. She always had ranch with chicken fingers. Okay, so I bring the chicken fingers back, and Mark Warzeka, you know, we're chit chatting, and
now Mark is directing at this time.
Or Mark is in the cast this time. Yep. And Mark Warzeka says, Mary Beth, you improvise, don't you? And I'm like, and I was very honest. I was like, I wrote one show in college through improv, and I'm taking my first level one next week, and I'm really excited about it. And he's like, yeah, well, you have some experience, and they kind of told me what was going on, and they're like, okay. And I was like, that was strange. I don't know what's going to happen. And then I saw Mark a little bit later, and he's like, would you like to play the set with us tonight? We think you're great, and we'd love to have you play. And I was like, sure, why not? You know, like not believing in a million years that this would be my job.
So how are you feeling now? They ask you to do this. What's going on in your head?
I honestly was like, that would be really hilarious for all the people I serve drinks to all night. Like, I didn't think beyond that. I was just like, this would be a cool time to get to play with them, and I'm excited about it. I didn't really feel afraid. I was just kind of like, whatever, because I really, truly was like, this will be a once-in-a-lifetime chance to get to play with them. Why not? I'm not going to get this job.
So you go up there, and what happens?
I had an awesome set. I had an incredibly fun set. I really did. I remember one line. It was very blue, but I tend to play very blue anyway. But the one line I remember, I was singing a song in front of, the scene was in front of a student, like a pep rally. And I was brought up with Mark Evan Jackson, and I believe I was like the substitute teacher, and he was the coach. And we were giving a lecture on how we all needed, like there needed to be less making out and less interesting, you know, things happening in kids' cars. Like, let's just say, no more trips to Lover's Lane in the parking lot. And I think he said, or I said something like, I started singing, "You've got yours-a, and I've got mine-a. Yours is a penis, and mine is a vagina." Okay, thank you, substitute teacher. And they cut me off. That's the one line I remember from that I was extremely dirty. So be really blue, and you'll get hired for the Second City Main Stage.
And then they ask you again, because they don't hire you on this first time.
They did not hire me that
first
time.
What is going on between doing the first one and now doing the second one? Did you think it was a fluke?
No, I didn't think it was a fluke. After that set, I was kind of like, this could be crazy, but I might get this job. Like, who knows? I had a really good set, and that was fun. But I did see the girl, like, they were bringing up people every night, and I was still cocktail waitressing, so I was seeing all the people.
Were you judging them as they were doing it?
Yeah.
Okay. and as you watched them, did you feel, like, objective, like, I might have a really good chance?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, for sure. There were two girls that were very good, and I thought they would be the people that I would be up against. But as I will say, as they were bringing more people up, I felt more and more confident that this could be a reality. And then I took my first level one improv class that next week with Kirk Hamley, who ended up being a writing partner of mine. We did lots of shows together. But I took that first class, and it was after that first level one class that they brought me back for a second set. So technically, I did take one class.
And then you got hired off that second set?
About like 4 or 5 days later. Yeah, Joe Janes approached me and said I got the job.
And then what did you feel like when they threw you into the cast?
Pardon?
What did you feel like when they threw you into the cast?
Oh, then it was just terror. Mm-hmm. Then I was like, oh, I'm completely not ready for this. I have no idea what I'm doing. I think the cast knew I was coming in very unprepared. So I think that they were very, I got a lot of notes. I got a ton of notes. Like the first 3 to 4 months of my experience was just like, hey, you know, like, you know, there's this thing called denial. Like, I mean, it was like that basic of like the rules, and we don't like to ask a lot of questions. And I'm like, oh, I better tear up this scene I wrote called Questions. Right. You know, like, I mean, it was just terrible.
And how did you deal
rule
with
breaking?
That? Here you are. You're learning on the job,
yeah.
And people are telling you, oh, you got to do, Mary Beth, I got to give you another note. I got to give you another. How did you take
it? I was really welcoming of it because I did feel very overwhelmed, and I was at the prime of people pleasing for myself at that point. So I was really like, how can I make this better? And are you guys okay? And do you like me? And I'm sorry, I don't deserve this job, but let's have fun. You know, like, I was just very.
That's my life at 50. I just want to let you know.
Yeah, I was just trying to keep it light and positive and like, I will take your notes and I will do my best. The only time that I actually, and I'm sure Keegan won't mind me telling the story, the only time that I got overwhelmed with the note giving, because it was a lot in the beginning, was Keegan would like to preface his notes with, sweetheart. Honey. And just this very, like, almost fatherly kind of lead-in, and I just one night was like, you know what? I'm your peer! You need to stop calling me honey, I'm your peer! And that was my major freak out at Keegan-Michael Key.
But watching, you know, as a waitress watching Second City, you had to be learning a lot.
Oh, a ton.
Because today, students don't go to shows as much. What were you learning by watching?
I think the biggest thing, because the person I went in for was Margaret Exner, and her character work was out of control amazing. She just created such incredible characters, and I had watched her create part of the show that I came in on, and so I got to kind of see the germination of her creating a character in the middle of an improv set, and then watching that character transform from the situation that happened on that first night when everything was new and have being created, and then watch it develop and build throughout the course of 3 weeks into this rich character with an incredible world, and you know, the relationship with the other characters develop and grow. So that was probably the biggest lesson I learned of, like, yeah, this improvisation thing is awesome, and that's where the germs of these great ideas come from, but then look at what it turns into is this brilliant, poignant scene with this character that you end up falling in love with and quoting on the ride home. You know, that was a huge lesson of, like, oh, it's not just make-em-ups, it's for the Second City, it's purposeful, it's to create characters and scenes, and so that was a big thing I learned. But also, I mean, they were all really good friends to the Second City Detroit cast. So getting to see, I think one of the things that was so attractive about wanting to be a part of that cast was just also seeing how much fun that they were having, and that they were this second family to each other. And I think seeing how they interacted off stage when I was bringing them drinks after the show, or, you know, hanging out with them at the bar afterwards, and kind of seeing the dynamics of an ensemble and how an ensemble works in that downtime was, I think I realized later, very wonderful for me to learn, because, you know, the ensemble, I think, is the one of the most difficult things about the Second City sometimes.
In what way?
Well, it can be extremely dysfunctional, and it can be extremely amazing. I mean, it's like some of the people I've performed with, all of the people I've performed with, I have this rich history with that I think is as deep as family ties. And you get to know someone so extremely well because their hearts are on display the entire time they're doing a process. And you're getting to know so much about their psyche and their families and their lives and their perspective of the world. So you just get to know them so well. And then if things happen in that ensemble that you don't, you have to work together, like a family has to stay together. So if you don't get along, it's like you are stuck with them. You're stuck in that situation.
And it seems too, like, when people get on the main stage especially, there's so many expectations and there's so much history. The pressure just, I mean, compared to Detroit, had to be through the roof.
Through the roof, yeah. Yeah, I mean, when we were in the Second City Detroit stage and we were remounting, we did a remount of the show Paradigm Lost, and yeah, right? And and so we're like watching this amazing show and we're putting it up again, and actually had the pleasure of Jim Zulovic coming back and doing a couple nights with us in his roles on the main, you know, on our stage, just like learning about the Second City. And I'd, you know, honestly, of course, I had to learn about the Second City of Chicago very quickly while I was on stage at the Second City Detroit. So it was just this very quick education. But yeah, I mean, that when I moved to Chicago, I was like, I think I definitely feel like I can do this job now, because I did 4 main stage shows. I really think I could do the Second City Chicago. And then you get there and the faces are all on the walls and you're, you know, seeing Stephanie Weir on stage. That was the first show I got to see live, was Stephanie Weir, after I've watched all her tapes a million times. And then, yeah, when I moved to Chicago, it really hit me.
And a lot of times, too, when you come, people from Detroit or Toronto, there's kind of like, you're cutting in line. Did you feel any of that?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And how did you deal with that? As a people pleaser. Not as a person, but as a people pleaser.
You know, it's
because I would want to be liked, you know?
Oh, yeah. I tried really hard to be liked, you know. And I had really just uncomfortable situations happen of when I finally got opportunities. Like when I was hired into Green Co., the woman whose place I was taking ended up being fired. And I was taking her place. And I knew this going in, and to the producer at the time, I said, I would really like to make sure that the cast knows I'm coming in and being hired before I show up at said rehearsal you're inviting me to. Are they going to know? Oh, yeah, we're going to let them know. We'll tell them. It's no problem. And I show up at the rehearsal, like, and I had come from a corporate gig and had, like, a plate of food, like, just like a douchebag, and, like, walked into the rehearsal, like, hey, guys, isn't this going to be great? This is going to be fun, like, eating a sandwich. And they're like, what are you doing here? And I was like, oh, yeah, I'm part of the cast now. And they're all like, oh, we had no idea, and it got dead silent and very awkward. And then the producer comes in and tells the group in front of me as I'm finishing said sandwich that I have this part now. And, you know, the former actress has been fired. So that didn't help, you know, the whole, like, Detroit people coming in and me coming in from another city. Like, I think there could have been some things that could have facilitated that transition a little bit easier. But overall, I was kind of young. You know, I was young and dumb, too, at the time, Jimmy. So, like, it was very much like, if they don't like me now, I'll get them to like me. You know, like, very, like, gung-ho positive attitude.
And where did you get that? Because the research that I've done on you is, I don't know why I'm having trouble getting this sentence out, but I am, was that you grew up in Michigan.
Yes.
You were a tomboy. Yes. You hung around a lot of, like, 3 of your friends growing up were all boys.
Yes.
You grew up in a Lutheran school.
Yes.
Is that part of your confidence and part of, like, the gung-ho-ness?
Yeah, I think competition was a big part of my family and my childhood. I had 3 older brothers. I had 3 boys that lived next door to me, and I wanted to play sports and keep up with them. And it was, sports were very revered in my house. Like, it was like, we were going to, you know, there was a part of it that was like, we're going to high school and so we can get college, you know, athletic scholarships. Like, that would be the dream scenario. Like, not so much the academic, more so the sports. So I definitely had a competitive nature, but also just being around so many men from young age, you know, up through now, I just never felt like, I never felt intimidated by them to a certain degree.
And even in improv, right?
Even in improv. Yeah, even when I didn't know what I was doing, I was like, I'll go toe-to-toe to you, let's do this. You know, like, I didn't feel any type of, I still don't know that I understand, like, gender politics to a certain degree when it comes to improvising.
And you also said,
I think I ignore it because I'm just like, how can I beat this situation that's happening and get in there and play? You know?
So you're very competitive as a person.
Yeah, I think I'm competitive with myself. I definitely am one. I don't think that, like, there's a limited amount of work and we're all trying to get that work. I mm-hmm. feel I come at it like there's enough work for everybody. What work am I going to get?
So if I say somebody that would be your type in Los Angeles got a part, mm-hmm. how would you react to that?
I would be totally fine with it.
Okay.
Truly. I mean, if I was up for the same part, I would more go like, okay, what did I do? What could I have done better? What am I in control of? Mm-hmm. You know, what can I change that I was in control of, as opposed to wipe them all out and, you know, sabotage and all that.
I do that to all of those things, but I do it to myself.
You do it to yourself.
I blame myself and I sabotage myself. Let's talk about workaholics and how'd you get that job?
I got it the old-fashioned way. I auditioned. The breakdown came out and my agent set me up with the audition. I was actually the first person to audition for the role of Alice Murphy. The casting director, Alyssa Weisberg, said I was the first call that came in to audition. And I went in for Alyssa. I was put on tape. The tape was sent to the producers. They liked it. I brought in for a producer session, and then I tested twice, and I booked it.
But there was also a Chicago connection.
Oh, yes.
Someone had seen
the
Second City show you were in.
Yes, Anders had seen.
Anders
Holm had seen.
He was one of the creators.
Yes, he's one of the creators.
Which one is he?
He's the tall, lanky, kind of powdery, attractive one.
Okay. Who's the guy with the weird hair? Who's the guy with the weird hair?
Oh, I hope he hears this. Yeah. Blake is the one with the weird, as you said, weird hair.
Okay.
Curly hair.
Well,
they're my bosses.
Clear, so I said weird.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they don't really get high in real life. That's...
No, I think they do get high. not all of them. You know, two of them are fathers now.
Okay.
Yeah, so two of them have children now, so I think that's probably adjusted and to lifestyles, but they do still party.
Have you seen them, like, mature? Because I would imagine, in terms of, you put the show out, Workaholics, it becomes a brand. And it's a very successful show. Now you got to be, like you talked at the beginning, a little more protective. Have you seen those guys, like, take it more as a business?
Oh, I think they were very smart businessmen going into it. I think they did a great job of insulating the creative team that created the show and protect them. And, you know, when they talk about being like bromance, bro squad, commanders of a friendship army, that is all true. I mean, they are that tight, and they protect each other. But I have seen, I will say, I do think that they've blown up, as you've seen, of like Adam doing more movies and Anders doing more recurring roles on TV and doing other projects. They're writing a movie now. So I definitely see, I mean, it's like with anything, I think you just see this confidence in them and this, I don't know how to say this without sounding like, I don't know, it's a little, not demeaning, what's the word I'm looking for, patronizing, but like they do seem more comfortable in their skin and more confident as businessmen in the industry.
Do you feel more confident, more comfortable the same way they do with your success?
Yeah, I feel confident with it. I mean, I definitely, you know, like we were talking backstage, I definitely feel like if all of this would have happened 10 years ago, I wouldn't have been ready for it.
What would have happened if you had it 10 years ago?
Well, I think I would have blown it. I mean, I wasn't in the place that I'm at now. You know, like I have been sober for almost 5 years now.
Congratulations.
And thank you very much. And that was a huge, you know, change for me. And I think at the time, like I was flown out to audition for SNL when I was 25, and you know, I completely blew it because of nerves and the pressure. And I think I just wasn't at as confident a place now as I am now. So I just think I would have been just ill prepared.
That really makes me feel great because I'm sober too, and it's
great.
It's because we're wired to be self-sabotagers.
Absolutely.
You know, and push everything away. You know. So it's nice. There's no way I'd be doing this podcast or being married if I wasn't sober.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
And I can't imagine dealing with sick. I think people don't understand that in a lot of ways. And I'm asking you, success is harder than failure. Do you feel that? Like to deal with the success?
Yeah. You know, I will say it's been nice to feel a little bit more stable. You know, the stability that comes with success is definitely a really great feeling. But there is this, you know, even coming to do, like if you would have asked me 6 years ago to do this podcast, I'd be like, sure, whatever. And now there is this more like, what am I walking into? I think I ask myself more questions of like, what if this comes up, or what do I feel comfortable bringing up? How am I presenting myself? There's more pressure of just how you look and how you are perceived, and that I think has been, that it just naturally gets heightened
right.
with the more success that
For
you
me,
have.
It's always, the success I get, there's always that ping in the head, you don't deserve it. Do you ever get
for
that?
Sure. Yeah, for sure.
How do you?
Like even I just, you know, I'm going into two shows this coming fall.
The Brink is
one of them, and then Workaholics, thank you so much. Uh-huh. And it just, I'm still just like, oh, you know, I'm already sweating about it, and I'm already worrying about it, and I'm already like, God, I hope I don't F it up. And I've been doing Workaholics for five, you know, this will be our fifth season.
Do you have that thing like, I'm going to be fired? Because, ever or not?
I don't think it's more of just like, if I can be funny enough, or if I make the right choices, or if I'm loose enough in the situation that I'm making the right choices for the character. I think I get more minute in my worries than the big picture of being fired.
Are you a perfectionist?
Yes.
And how does it manifest in your work?
Well, I am very, very prepared, mm-hmm. always.
Overly prepared?
Overly prepared,
okay.
For sure.
Like, you know other people's lines, too?
No, okay. No, not that far. Not that far. But I do go so far as, like, okay, I know how, you know, Jillian likes to do this. What do I think her choices might be? And, you know, that I can really kind of imagine what choices they might make as I'm making my choices for my character, which is probably a little above and beyond and a little too planning. I mean,
right.
It's like we're supposed to be in the moment, and I'm like, let me just think of every way this could go wrong. I think that's probably the way I'm the biggest perfectionist, is how can this fall apart, and how can I prepare myself to steel myself in case it does fall apart, or have, you know, life rafts to jump
right.
to.
Why is it that we never think like, because I'm the same way, we go to the disaster. It's
yes.
always this catastrophe kind of thing. It's never like, oh, if I do this, maybe I'll get an Oscar. You know, it's never.
Yeah,
why don't
no,
we ever
it's
think
never.
Like that?
You're absolutely you know? Right. It's never. No, it's not. It's that how, you know, how will I pick myself up from the humiliation that just unfolded?
Right, because we're always going to be humiliated.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
Let's improvise. We're
okay.
going to take a suggestion. We'll do about 10 minutes. What do you like to take as a suggestion?
You know, lately, I like places that people gather, but
okay.
it's just the two
great.
Of us.
Great. So could we have a location where two people could gather?
Starbucks.
A Starbucks. Great. And then when you hear that, what's going on in your mind?
I went through, like, you know, a list of all the people that might be at a Starbucks barista. I was thinking, I actually had the thought of, like, a homeless person walking into a Starbucks.
Okay.
I don't know where that came from, but mm-hmm. that was a thought that I just had.
And then will you become that character? Is it more of
yes.
a character? Okay.
Yes. It's always character-based for me.
So you hear Starbucks and you think homeless person,
yeah.
you think a barista. But when you're thinking of barista, you're thinking of a specific barista, right? A character?
Or
the role?
Not this particular time, but it usually the next step would be, okay, barista, I think I'll be a barista. What is this about this barista?
Okay, great. Get to it in just a second. You're here early today.
Yeah, I yeah.
You look nice.
Thank you.
Got a job interview?
Actually, yeah, I'm leaving my current employment.
You left your resume here yesterday.
Glad you got that. You can keep that.
Oh.
You can keep that. It's also my headshot if you flip it over.
Yeah.
I hear that's what actors do. So.
Oh.
I thought it might help me. I've been told I have a nice smile.
You have a beautiful smile.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah.
My front teeth are going in.
Yeah, I've been noticing.
They're indenting in.
Yeah.
They're like turning in on themselves.
Right.
Well, my front teeth are pointing to the back of my throat. Yeah.
Well, we have dental here, so.
I heard that.
Yeah. All you have to do is work 30 hours and they give you dental.
I have to say, I have read some articles where it's like getting that 30 hours, though, is a bit tricky. I mean, do you, James, ever make 30 hours?
James. I didn't know how you knew my name. But
oh, you wear a name tag.
Yeah. Well, some weeks I put in 30, and then some weeks I have to travel to another Starbucks out of state, but I still
dip.
Get the...
Yeah. You got a double dip.
Yeah, yeah.
God.
But there's a bus that takes us up to Wisconsin. There's some Starbucks in Wisconsin.
You go all the way.
Yeah, to make my insurance, yeah.
See, that's the kind of devotion. I mean, I gotta say, I would have insurance at other jobs just thrown at me like I'm a, you know, like singles at a strip bar, you know, just throwing insurance, making it rain insurance. I just feel like it was so easy, you know? I don't know, there's something about the twinkle in your eye, the stains under your arms that just make me feel that, like, sometimes it's better to work for something. You look like a fulfilled person.
Yeah, I'm...
That's fighting for insurance. That's fighting for it. I guess I love that challenge.
Well, I mean, if you want to fill out an application, I could put in a good word for you.
Good. Okay, why not? Let's do this.
Okay.
I mean, that's why I left my resume.
Oh, really?
I did. That's why I left it. I know this is crazy. I don't know. I've been going to a lot of tax firms, right? I don't know why I'm talking out of the side of my mouth right now. I've been going to a lot of tax firms. I have a little paralegal experience, and I don't know, it seemed like the safe route. And I was here last week, and I saw you. I mean, you made a heart on top of that cappuccino. That's not a Starbucks thing. That's not a Starbucks thing.
I don't do it for everyone.
Well, let's just say it moved me, and that foam heart just made me say, I'm just going to leave one, leave a resume, see what happens.
Well,
and look at what's happening! Yeah.
I mean, this isn't an interview. You've got to fill out the application first. I mean,
absolutely. I can totally do that. But,
yeah.
You know, we're bonding.
Yeah.
You know, we're kind of making a connection. Heart on the phone.
So let me get to that resume.
That'd be great.
Yeah. I actually filled out the part where it says reference. I put my name and all my information there.
Thanks, James. Sweet of you.
No problem, Carol.
See, your number's here, too.
Yeah. You know, the only thing, and I don't even know why I'm bringing this up, is Starbucks employees can't date each other. I don't know why I brought that up.
James.
Yeah. You're ripping it up? If you could put it in recycle and not...
Always true about the seven. You can't tear it past seven.
One more thing. My number was on there. don't dig through the trash. I mean the recycling.
What if I order a coffee and instead of giving you my name, I'll give you my phone number, and you can write it on the cup.
That'd be great.
And then when I finish it, I'll leave it on the bar. It's really elaborate.
Next?
I think it could work.
Next?
Excuse me. Yeah. I'd like a double espresso, please.
Double espresso?
Too small of a cup. I'll take a venti.
Slow up.
I'll take a venti skinny mocha chino light ice.
heart foam on top.
Would you like any baked goods?
Yes, I'd like a muffin, please.
Okay. Would you like a blueberry or a poppy seed?
Just a brand. It doesn't really matter, James. Just
my choice? Is that
no, it's your choice. Your choice. Your choice. Just poppy. Very anxious to give you my number.
Great. There you go. I think you're going to like that. Very moist.
Oh.
We got a new supplier.
Is it too moist?
No, not can't be too moist.
Oh, it can be too moist. It can definitely be too moist. If I have dry mouth and I eat a muffin and it's too moist, well.
Then you know what? Maybe we
I
should go
choke
with...
myself to death.
Yeah.
And what kind of love story would that be, James?
If I saved your life, it would be a beautiful one. But I can replace that muffin. We have a policy. If you don't like what we have in the case and you're not satisfied.
Even if I take a bite out of it?
Yeah. Are you okay?
It was almost too dry.
Okay.
Almost too dry.
Here's some water. Here's some water.
Thank you.
I'm sorry about that. I'm not going to charge you for the muffin.
Oh, thank you.
My fault.
Okay. It's like, the movie Terms of Endearment was just flashing through my mind. That was happening. I don't know why. It was weird.
Yeah. We don't want those kind of movies in your mind when you with Starbucks. We're looking for a positive.
Yeah.
I'm so nervous.
Oh, don't be nervous.
No. This is the closest I've ever come to being in a relationship.
If I'm honest with myself, it's the closest I've ever come to.
Really?
I mean, I was married for 7 years.
Is he abusive?
No, just...
I'm sorry, that was...
No!
On the first date, that is not the question to ask.
Oh my God, okay.
I'm buying you coffee.
You just bought me a muffin?
Yeah.
That was exciting.
Yeah.
It was an exciting muffin.
That was amazing.
James, let's just get out of here. Let's just get out of here. Just take off that adorable apron. I will peel that name tag off of you. And we... are gonna go to a different coffee shop. Just you and me.
That sounds
we'll go
wonderful.
We'll go tea coffee bean.
Okay.
We'll toilet paper coffee bean or.
Can you just wait 90 seconds?
Oh,
because
God.
Carol's on break and she's gonna come and she'll cover me.
Wait, you work with another Carol?
Yes. No.
I'm Carol.
I know you're Carol.
But I'm not the only Carol in your life.
You are the only Carol in my life.
No,
she's Carol the bitch Carol. Manager. You're Carol.
What's my nickname? Or my title? So that's what color pants you're wearing.
At one point in the scene, I'm getting to improvise with Mary Beth Monroe.
Oh my goodness.
Yes.
Wow,
yeah,
thanks.
Yes. What'd you feel about that scene? I loved it.
It was very good. You know, I mean, I don't know if I'm learning that what you've said about yourself is similar to me. Like I do kind of go like, what did I miss?
Right.
What did I miss?
What is your head going right now? What are you missing?
Well, I do feel like I had a little trip up in when you presented the resume. Like, right. I feel like I do this sometimes that I feel like I go like, what's Jimmy doing? You know, like, what's he trying to
You're
do?
You're trying to get in my head.
Opposed to being, so I had a moment there where I feel like I was trying to get into your head a little bit, which can't, it's not that that's necessarily bad, but mm-hmm. I do feel like I wasn't. In an organic connecting mm-hmm. place with you in that moment. So I felt a little step up there, but overall I think it grew and changed and I think we were exploring it in
right.
a delightful way.
I loved at the beginning that, I mean, it was obvious and you made such a strong choice that there was attraction between these two, which I think was which was so great. And there was some history, because usually a Starbucks, people are, you know, like it's the first time at the Starbucks, and that usually goes nowhere.
Right.
For me, at the when we were doing the coffee thing, like, that's where I got a little lost, because I'm like, where is our game going? I need to add something to it. It just felt like I was doing, I lost what I was started with.
Yeah.
And then we found it again, but...
Well, and I did, you know, I was actually a worker there at the
Were
top.
Were you?
Yeah, at first.
Oh,
yeah.
I didn't know that.
So, and I was noticing, it almost like it flipped on itself.
Yes.
Because I was noticing, I thought you were finishing your coffee at the station as a...
I was.
Patron.
Yes, I was.
And so then when you had made me the employee, I was like, oh, well, we'll just...
So how do you swing?
You guys don't know what I was thinking.
How do you swing with that when that comes up?
Just I do that and make a joke like they don't know what I was thinking. No, I do. I just kind of roll with it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think I could have. It just felt like in that moment I could have stuck with being a coworker with you, but it just felt more organic to not be. And then you followed it up with. I think when you said you left your resume here, it came very soon after that.
Right.
Or there was another line just before that that was like, I'm clearly not working here. Mm-hmm. So. I just rolled with it. I changed my choice.
Because I started out, I was a patron with the thing, and then I was, I just got, I don't know, it. I just got to, okay, I'm working here.
Yeah.
You know, which to me is usually like fun because the audience doesn't know you're trying to figure it out, and it surprises you at the same time.
Exactly.
Keeps, for a control freak like myself, it's good. Are you a control freak?
It keeps it
too?
Fresh. To a certain degree, I've gotten a lot better. I think I used to be a much bigger control freak.
What do you try to control?
Oh, you know, I do really, like, I'm a little weird in, like, exercise. Like
compulsive exercise?
Not compulsive, but if I don't do, like, 4 workouts a week or 3 workouts a week, I can be very down on myself. So sad.
No, I totally get it.
It's like little things like that. Like, I'm very particular about being on time, and like I don't like being a minute late. Like, little things like that. But
was your family? Because my family was notorious late, always late. My mom's
notoriously early.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's the Lutheran thing,
yeah,
right?
Lutheran. Okay. Very much.
Catholics didn't care. My mom would say it didn't matter if it was a show or going to church or going to, they're going to be late anyways.
Yeah.
Everything's going to be late.
Oh.
And you'd go there and it wasn't. And you felt ashamed. All right, let's take some questions for Mary Beth. If we could turn the lights on. There we go. Yes, right here.
Hi, Mary Beth.
Hi.
So it seemed like Second City's experiment with hiring somebody, bringing them up on stage, worked out pretty well. Do you ever feel like maybe there's too much sort of gatekeeperism in comedy? Maybe there are too many obstacles to keep people from getting a chance to...
Yeah, I think... But I also think it's such a deep bench in comedy. I mean, I know... That's why I think I felt so much guilt coming when I came to Chicago of like, why is it, you know, this is going so easy for me when you meet all the, you know, the people who moved here and had been here for years and years and years and waiting to get hired, and for the producers to have to siphon through that. There are so many people that want those coveted jobs and want the certain jobs that exist in both the Second City, I.O., all those places, that I think there have to be gatekeepers just because there are so many people that want to do it. But I mean, in what I'm doing now, like out in LA, it's like, how many auditions do you need me to see me do the same thing? Like, it does just feel like everybody wants to be absolutely sure that they're making the right decision. So I understand it, but can it be frustrating? Yeah, I'm sure, especially for people who had been waiting, you know, 10 years to get hired into a tour co or onto the main stage. Like, yeah, that's incredibly frustrating. But I do think it's a necessity. Is it always handled in the best way? No. But I do think it's a necessity on some level.
Great. Back here.
I really like what you said about how you don't think there's a limited amount of work that everybody's competing for.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people do think that is the case.
Yeah.
Why do you think so many people...
Well, because you fall in love with the idea of success, and you fall in love with celebrity, and you fall in love with that
role? Why didn't I get that one role? And why didn't she get that role? You know, why did she get that role? So I just think we have these huge ideal, you know, these ideals of what we want to achieve. And when they don't happen quickly enough, I think you can get into a tendency of not being accountable for what you are in control of, and you want to blame everybody else for your lack of, and I just find it to be pointless. Like, what's the point of that? It's wasted energy. I mean, I could squeeze another workout in this week with all that energy, or I could, you know, like, there's a million other things I could be doing that are proactive. But yeah, I just think it's easy. And I also think it is frustrating when you, like, let's say you legitimately don't think someone's a very good actor and they're beating you, you know, they're getting every role you want. It can get extremely grating. But yeah, I've always, you know, my mother and a few other people have said this to me, you know, that another person's success is not my failure, you know. My success is not another person's failure, and I really try to hang on to that. That who knows what my path will be, and who knows what anybody's path will be in this industry, and you just gotta enjoy what you're doing.
Another question? Dan?
Yeah, first of all, it's such a contrast to see you, you're so smiling, your character's always so distraught, like her plug's gonna come out of the wall any minute, and yeah. That's fun. You mentioned about making choices for your character in a particular scene. Is that something that you get to do a lot, or is the director giving you choices that maybe sometimes you don't agree with?
Well, Alice was very specific, right? I mean, she was written very specifically, and so I knew she was written so well, in my opinion, especially in the audition material that I received, that I knew exactly what to do with her. She's, you know, capital B and doesn't give a shit and, you know, is the mama bear of the office. So it was very easy to make those choices. You know, on the, it was easier for me to do what I needed to do for her. But like with The Brink, that was something I did go back and forth with tremendously. It's a show I'm going to be doing on HBO that's starring Tim Robbins, Jack Black, and Pablo Schreiber. And I'm playing Tim Robbins' chief of staff. And she's not a capital B. She's very much type A personality, but very much a man, you know, babysitter to Tim Robbins. And so it was different, but having come off of a set of where I was playing something so specific like Alice, I did kind of have to, you know, get into a different mind frame and kind of re-examine what I wanted to do with her specifically. But yeah, I mean, there's been times on set that I've been like, that what you want me to do doesn't feel comfortable. I don't know how to give you what I think you're asking me to do. I can't organically do it. And then we talk about it and we move on. But if they're a good director, which knock on wood, I've worked with quite a few, they totally understand that they're not going to force you to make a choice that you're not going to, you know, come across as giving, you know, as a truthful choice. So they'll work with you to make it yours, which is how it should be.
With someone like Alice, you know, and she can be so harsh, you know, how do you make it still funny? Like, so it doesn't go to be
shrill?
Yes.
Oh, she can get a little shrill sometimes. Sometimes I watch and I'm like, ooh, you're really going for it with that face, aren't you? I just committed to that horrifying look. So it can get, again, going back, looking at your choices, but I try to keep it in the world of, you know, the big thing I told the boys is that what I'm always thinking about when I'm looking at them in a scene is that I fucking hate you and you don't fucking matter to me. Like, that's like the two thoughts that are going through my head of like, which I think keeps it grounded. Because if I was just flying off the handle all the time, which I definitely can do, then I think it would come across as too big, too broad. She's just not likable. But if you can see, and plus the audience is like, she's right. Like, what are they doing? I mean, these guys are idiots. So I think they totally are like, of course she's reacting that way, because I even get called like the coolest boss ever. Like, that's the big thing with the fans is like, you're the coolest boss. Because why don't I fire these people? Why have I not fired these guys? Like, obviously there's a part of me that like deals with them and I, you know, tolerate them, but yeah.
How much is playing Alice? You've talked about being a people pleaser, being nice, is just therapy. You get to be a bitch.
It's a blast. You know? It's delightful. It's total playground. It's all the things I can never, I don't feel like I can ever do or say in real life. So it's total therapy. It's a relief, a release. It's a blast.
Does some Alice sometimes come out, you know, in your life?
My fiancé is in the audience.
Andy
so,
is.
Yes.
Can Andy, we ask him? Is that okay?
Sure.
It does.
She's an angel.
Ah! Andy Cobb.
Every second better than the procedure. Oh.
and he just blew you a kiss.
Oh, he
congratulations.
Oh,
when are you guys getting married?
July 13th we are getting married.
Are you
Sunday, July 13th?
Are you nervous about that? Because I was a basket case getting married.
I'm very nervous.
Because you were living together, right?
Yes.
You're living together.
Yep.
And getting married, it's even more intense. And I don't care if you're living together or not. How are you guys doing with this? I'm worried about you.
We're doing good. You know, I think we both want to be married. Like, that's just not even a question. We are very much in love, and they're, you know, we have so much fun together, and I just think that's the no-brainer part, but a wedding is really a huge beast.
Are
that
you are your parents paying for it, or you paying for it?
Oh no, I'm paying for it.
Okay,
we're paying.
Is
for it
in? Is it going to be back in Michigan?
No, it's going to be in Malibu, California.
Oh, good for you.
Thank you.
Good for you.
Thank you. On the beach, and found a really cute little spot there that we love, and it's part of this like this historical house in the California State Parks.
So. Big wedding, small wedding.
We would like it to be smallish, but that's not going to happen.
What's so. Smallish?
You know, we were shooting for 100 people.
Okay.
And it's already above and beyond.
And has your mom been... It's nice in one way that she's not paying for it, because my mother-in-law paid for it, and it was just...
Oh, that's... But they have a lot of say. Nice to get it paid for.
Yeah, but you earn it.
Yes.
You
know? Yeah.
So... Is your mom, is any issues coming up with your mom around it?
The only thing my mom said is that she's like, if you, you know, whatever suits your, you know, you want your father to wear coming down the aisle, just know that a gray suit makes him look really old. Is really the extent. So she doesn't want me to have him in a gray suit. But otherwise, she's been pretty easy about it. Both, and my mother-in-law-to-be has been, everybody's been really easygoing about it.
And are you guys working?
I've been so on my own for so long too that I think they're like they know that these that I.
When did you?
Like I moved out of my parents' house when I was 18.
Any reason? Just
I just really it was funny when I was 12 years old. I said to myself, and I remember laying in bed going, when I turn 18 years old, I'm going to move out of this house, and I'm going to get a tattoo. And I did both of those things.
And where is your tattoo?
It's a tramp stamp. Do you ever hear one of those?
Yeah, it's on the back. It's
on
above your
back.
Above your butt crack.
Exactly. Right above my butt crack. Right above my butt crack. Yep. And it's really original.
What
it's
is
like
it?
I thought long the you know, and I knew what I wanted from when I was 12 years old, but it's creative and original. It's a butterfly.
Does it look like it's flying out of your butt crack?
You know, if we're lucky enough to have some kids, I bet just walking it'll fly eventually. Something to look forward to.
Yeah. Do you want to have kids?
I would love to have kids, yeah.
Okay.
For sure. Mm-hmm.
Are your parents really proud of your success?
Very proud of my success, but they my mom, I think, makes loving hints that she wishes that maybe it wasn't a show like Workaholics that I got such success on. It's not quite for their generation, Workaholics, my parents' generation. They get it, and they understand why. The kids think it's funny, but they are
what do they say?
Pretty mortified every time they watch it.
Oh, is there a little shame that you're on it, you think?
For me?
No, for them.
Oh, for them?
Like they can't tell their parents? You know, well, she's on that Comedy Central show. Which one? It doesn't matter. It's on Comedy Central.
Yeah, they don't. You know, I think they kept it kind of a secret. They didn't tell a lot of, like, the people they knew from church and all of that. But then when younger kids, like, my mom worked at a bank, so she would... You know, they'd say Monroe, and like it would get around that like she was the mother of this character of the show that these young kids really love on TV, and so they would come up to her booth, and as soon as that started happening, like people would go out of their way to be like, "I heard you were so and so's mom, and I love that show," and blah blah blah. Then it was like now I think she's a little bit more braggy about it and a little bit more accepting. So I think she got a little of that taste of starstruck kind of celebrity excitement.
She's like, I'm Alice's mom. Can I cash your check?
Yeah.
How do you want it?
Exactly.
Are you know, your mom was like 15 years at a bank, an accountant. Did you inherit, like, you're good with money because she was good with money? Or
I will say I'm very good. Yeah, I think I'm very good with money. I'm very responsible about it. My parents have always, you know, we were, you know, middle class, lower middle class growing up. But I definitely was instilled, like, you don't have credit card debt. You take care of your bills. You know, you don't overspend. My mom especially, yeah, was very good about teaching us that.
That is great. We got time for a couple more quick questions right over here.
I come from Oklahoma City, and we've got a small but growing improv community. And being on the is there a substitute? Like, I know eventually I'll have to come out here and take classes and go through the system and all that stuff. But how much would you weigh being on, like, the ground floor or something like that, and, like, growing in that kind of community, and then moving? How soon should I move or anything? Like, what in that?
Well, I would ask you, like, what are you getting to do in Oklahoma City? Like, are there classes available to you?
Classes,
are you performing?
Yes, and there's a lot of stage time where, like, I mean, I get to perform at least twice every time we have shows, which is like eight week runs. So,
Do you feel like there's this might be an easy way to decide? Do you feel like there's anything more that you can strive for when you're in Oklahoma? Like, is there an amazing improv group you'd love to audition and be a part of that you haven't gotten to do yet? Or are there classes you haven't taken? Or I would ask myself that if I were you. But ultimately, yeah, I think moving to Chicago was one of the best things I ever did. You're going to have an endless, a plethora of classes and amazing theaters you can study at here. It's the mecca of improv, Chicago is. So I think if you move here, you won't be disappointed. But I also would hate, I would hate for you to leave if there was something you're like, oh, I wish I would have done that before I left.
You've moved twice. I mean, Detroit to Chicago, mm-hmm. Chicago to LA. When did you know it's time to move on?
I always knew I wanted to go to LA. When I was in Detroit and I was in college theater, my theater program in college, I knew I was going to go to LA. This whole Second City journey, I quit college my junior year to go work for the Second City Detroit when I got this job. So it kind of sent me on this whole course. But even in my time in Chicago, like, I think we all, just being at the Second City Chicago, think Mad TV or SNL, or if one of those opportunities comes up, I'll go do that. So I kind of thought, like, maybe that would take me away from me moving to LA. But once that opportunity kind of passed for me, I knew. I think I left at the right time. I think I knew when I was done, and I got to LA as soon as I could. But I fell in love with, I wanted to have the whole Second City experience once I started in it. Once I fell in love with it, I was like, I want to do everything I can possibly do.
So when you were in Detroit, you didn't want to go to LA, you wanted to come to Chicago.
After the path of Second City started, and I brought those chicken fingers back to Naima. I was like, I'm going to stay, I'm going to go to Chicago now.
What advice would you give to somebody starting out today? One piece of advice.
I would say, I can't take credit for this quote because it's something that my friend Jamie Moyer always says, but I would say go big or go the fuck home. Like,
what does that mean?
Just be bold, make choices, especially if you're young. I feel like I miss how fearless I was to a certain degree in my 20s, where I just felt like I could do anything. And I had an invincibility that, yes, definitely got me in trouble, but I think it helped me to say yes when I was asked to do that improv set in Detroit, where I was like, fuck it, sure, and make bold choices and not be afraid and just put yourself out there. And with that comes great risk. Like, yes, you might fall on your face, but, just go for it and be brave. Be brave, because I don't think you can accomplish anything without taking big risks and being brave in the face of them, no matter what happens.
I want to ask you one more thing, because I've never had any success at commercials. You have done great at commercials.
Thank you.
I'm not even going to ask you how much money you made.
I appreciate
that. What is your success with commercials? Because there's so many improvisers that are auditioning in LA, Chicago, New York, all, what is your success on landing commercials?
What do you think I attribute?
Is a strategy you go in there? Do you say, I'm just going to be myself? Do you try to second guess what they're doing?
Or? You know, it's, I think I hit a stride with commercial work when I think for a while when I first came out to LA, I tried to, I'm gonna have them remember me. I'm gonna get them to remember me in this room, whether it's like improvising off the script or I'm gonna let, you know, like, hey, guy, you know, like, I don't know, just like, I think a little bit too cocky or like a little too in your face. And as soon as I said, you know, A, got sick of not booking as much as I have been as of late, but it just felt phony and it felt gross. And I, once I was myself and I relaxed and was pleasant, but didn't act like I was trying so hard and didn't, I think, reek of desperation, like, please hire me. And I just was relaxed and was, and really could go in the room and be like, I don't, it's okay if I get this and it's okay if I don't. Like, either way, I'm fine. And once I really owned that and it really felt that way, then I started booking like crazy.
How many auditions do you think it took you to get there?
To get to that point? I mean, I would say I went from booking maybe one commercial in the first 2 years I lived in LA to, you know, I at least now I have three or four running a year, five sometimes at a time. And I think it probably took like 2 years. I think it took like 2 years. And this is like, I mean, in LA, I'm auditioning for, God, like sometimes six commercials a week at most, sometimes maybe just a few, but I'm going out almost every day. And so you add all those up that it can be a lot of auditioning. But I think it took a while. I think it took like a good 2 years of me just being like, you know what? I'm not going to give a shit about this anymore. I'm not going to let it bother me one way or the other. And then, of course, as soon as that you really feel that way is when you book.
Yeah. Mary Beth Monroe, thank you so much. Woo! Workaholics, Comedy Central.
Yes, Comedy.
Drink, we don't know when it's going to come out. And there you have it. Another episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. And I'm guessing on this, it's episode 84. I don't really care about the numbers, but I think it's episode 84, the Mary Beth Monroe episode. And I want to thank Mary Beth Monroe for doing this interview. As we talked about in the interview, it was 2 years in the making, and I'm glad it happened. I also want to thank the Chicago Improv Festival, Jonathan Pitts and Kevin Mullaney, for making this happen and including us in this year's Chicago Improv Festival. We really felt honored to be a part of it. Also, I'd like to thank the good people here at Stage 773. They're our home base. They're the people that make us feel like such rock stars. And as always, my producer, Ben Caprero. He's the guy that makes it sound so slick and so professional. You wouldn't be hearing my voice if it wasn't for Ben, because I have nothing to do with it. I don't know anything about technical stuff. Ben Caprero does. Also, we're on Feral Audio. You've probably figured it out because you're smart people. And we're not alone there. It's a podcast collective. That means there's other people in the mix over there. There's other people podcasting and people like name dropping. Are you ready? Chelsea Peretti, Dan Harmon, Steve Agee, Todd Berry, Matt Dwyer. Names like that that do some really great podcasts. And all you have to do is go over to feralaudio.com to check it out. If you want more information about me and my award-winning classes, The Art of Slow Comedy, and my Improv Nerd blog, oh, you're going to love this. It's going to make you a better improviser. And sign up for the newsletter. We'll send you the blog every week and all information about what Jimmy's up to, including my police report. Also, go to our Facebook page, Improv Nerd, and like us. It really helps with my low self-esteem. I want to thank our sponsor, Hotel Lincoln, and I want to thank you for listening and all the wonderful emails and Facebook messages you send me. It means a lot to me. And thank you so much for listening. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd. Oh, yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd.
Hello, I'm Dave Ross.
Hey, and I'm Hampton Yunt.
And we host Suicide Buddies on Starburns Audio.
That's right. It's a podcast about suicide, but not to make light of it. We actually talk about suicidal thoughts, depression, kind of with a sense of levity that Dave and I have with each other. He's my best friend. Come on.
Yeah, we're buddies. Suicide Buddies.
That's the title.
One of our favorite episodes that we've recorded so far is about this guy, Jan Pataki, who was a Polish aristocrat in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And he, one of the reasons it's possible that he killed himself is that he thought he was a werewolf.
Oh.
Check out a clip. It also makes me think, like, we were talking about in the Norway black metal episode, how, like, just the culture of your surroundings can affect you. Like, he's in a castle in Poland. He's like, I mean, if you lived in a castle in Poland and no one knew anything about anything, you might be like, I'm a bat. I'm probably a bat.
That's like literally what happened to Batman. He literally is in his mansion. He's like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat. I'm a bat.
I'm a
bat that helps people.
I'm a bat that helps people.
I'm a rich...
I don't know what you want from me. And my girlfriend, she's a cat. She's a cat.
My girlfriend's a cat.
She steals things. She's a woman who steals things. She's a cat. I'm a bat.
I help people. She's a cat. We fight a penguin.
My